Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, are SSDs too hot? Thekus N2560. It's a NAS and a home theater PC. Asus Strix GTX 780 reviewed. MSI's X99S, the joy of glued-on screens and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 279, recorded August 7th, 2014. It's a NAS and a home theater PC.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by iFixit. You can fix it, and iFixit makes it easy with step-by-step repair guides, high-quality replacement parts, and all the tools you'll need. For $10 off your purchase of $50 or more, go to iFixit.com/twit and enter the code TWITCH at checkout.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most helpful, and most delightful news about computer hardware. We love the desktops, we love the mobiles, we love the laptops, we even love the tablets, and occasionally, but not today, we love cell phones. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Ryan Schrout. How are you, sir?
I actually love cell phones today. I mean, I had to use mine multiple times. Actually, I was disappointed because I had a notification on my door that I had a missed package that I had to sign for from the postal service. So they don't even make a return delivery attempt. I have to go to the post office. But they were trying to deliver my OnePlus One phone, which I was kind of excited to try out. So I totally missed that opportunity. But by next week, I'll have it for sure.
I almost had a ticket for a OnePlus One. A friend of mine had an extra one. And I responded to their tweet, like their direct message, like 5 minutes too late to get access to it. And I was like, no!
They're very strict about it. I kind of went into it going, I don't know much about this phone, but everybody talks about it. So I'm going to give it a shot and try it out and see if it lives up to expectations. I'm still like personally disappointed that you can't put it on Verizon. It's AT&T or T-Mobile. Yeah. It's just kind of a limiting factor for me. Yeah. Yeah. It's just kind of a limiting factor for me for full adoption because T-Mobile, no, just in terms of coverage, and then AT&T, no, because AT&T. Just because. Yeah. So I'll give it a shot. I've got one of those SIM cards. It's like $30 a month, T-Mobile, unlimited stuff that I just use for testing stuff. So we'll talk about that next week and see how impressive it is over other stuff, over the other more modern options out there.
Yeah, it's funny. We actually just got an Amazon Fire phone in for testing on Texilla and one of the new Windows phones. So I'm kind of curious about that.
Have yet to use one of those, but seem interesting still.
It's funny. There's issues with this Motorola G with micro SD cards. You know, it tells you that it's not mounted. It has issues with them. And they have a fix for it, which is part of Android KitKat 4.4.4, which is finished and being deployed. But because it's being deployed by carrier, you've got to remember, I bought this directly from Motorola. They're not making it available on the website until it's already rolled out on the carrier. So, you know, I'm talking to like tech support and they're like, well, you know, it's fixed in the patch that's coming out from your carrier eventually. And I'm like, I bought it from you guys. I want my patch. And they're like, well, you know, and they escalate me to level 2 and, you know, they go through this long discussion and they're like, yes, this is a problem. We know about this problem. It's fixed. We have the fix for it. Android KitKat 4.4.4 fixes this. I'm like, great. How do I download it? And they go through and they walk me through the USB page. And they're like, well, I don't see it there. I'm like, no, I don't see it there either. And they're like, oh, well, it'll be distributed when AT&T decides to. I'm like, what? So I hope they're doing some really awesome qualification testing. But it's as somebody who's been using iPhones for so long, it's absolutely mind-blowing to me to finally be in a situation where there's like known problems with my phone that are fixed that I can't fix because AT&T,
stinks.
I understand why Google gave the keys to the operating system rollouts to the carriers kind of, from a strategic standpoint and trying to get their foot in the door. But boy, it sucks for end users. It sucks for developers. It sucks for everybody. Not as bad as, however, replacing on a screen on an iPad 2. I will point out it's kind of convenient, right? We were replacing screens on Dytron today, and I was using the iFixit iOpener, which ironically is iFixit's a sponsor today. But glued-on screens, which are used in the Microsoft Surface, the iPad 2, several other iPad devices, Motorola X, Motorola G, I believe, definitely the Motorola Moto X, glue-on screens are Satan if you break one. I understand why they do them from a packaging standpoint because, you know, slim, nice, clean, yeah. simple, makes it difficult for users to get inside. But replacing it, the more shattered your screen is, the more tiny bits of glass you have to pull off the glue off the mastic. And, you know, the whole point of this weird little thing is you heat it in the microwave, lay it on the screen, and it heats up the glue below the screen, and you can basically pry it off. And it was one of the least pleasant experiences repairing something I think I've ever had in my life. that and the fact that they align above the bunch of the buttons internally by being glued. It's kind of funny, like the home button is held in by glue, two layers of glue on two separate pieces to the screen, and then that whole package lays down across a couple of touchpads, spring touchpads inside the base of the unit. It is brutal. It is like just awful to work on.
Did the heating pad part work though? That's the one thing that I don't really have yet and haven't had a need for yet. Hadn't had to replace something that had a glued on screen yet, but the idea of it seemed pretty neat.
Our conclusion was that, you know, if a guy in the mall is going to replace your iPad 2 screen for $100, pay the guy at the mall $100. But it was through no fault of the eye opener. It's such a strain in the tube. It worked really well. It's funny. It has some sort of all natural ingredient in it. I want to say buckwheat or something because you heat it and it smells like popcorn. And if they got the shot at one point, there was like me holding this down on the screen edge, right? So you heat it up in the microwave, then you place it down on the screen edge and basically heat, right? So you don't have to sit there with a heat gun. You don't have to play around with a bunch of stuff because using a heat gun on a screen's kind of not pleasant. It works, but it's kind of a nightmare. And then, you know, you let it sit for like 90 seconds, then you get your spudger out and you start prying the screen. Mm-hmm. It works. It works fine. But there's this one beautiful shot of me like holding the thing down and there's steam coming out from between my fingers. It looks like I'm about to burst into flame because I'm a vampire on a Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode. But yeah, now it actually works. Paid my own money for it, bought it out of pocket. And Pentalope screws suck, but not nearly as bad as glued on screens. Because at the same time, we did this iPad 2, we did an iPhone 5, which is essentially is two screws pull the screen off if you have a populated screen, two ribbon cables. And I got to say, it's amazing how good the quality is because we've got a screen for like $30 off of eBay and it was populated with the speaker, the front facing camera, the LCD and the digitizer, right? So you didn't have to try to, you know, remove all these incredibly sensitive components and reapply them for $30. Works perfectly, looks fantastic, so much easier than trying to replace those components and put them back down on. So, yeah, don't break your screen. And if you do...
Tip of the week.
If it's glued on, if you do research on your screen and it's glued on, you can fix it. But you might want to think twice about that one. You might want to have somebody else fix it. Speaking of fixing things, Thecus N2560 dual as in two NAS server, a budget home theater PC option. I am confused. Sebastian wrote this up, not with Sebastian or his article, but it's kind of funny to think of a server and a budget home theater PC as being the same thing.
It is kind of interesting. And I don't think it's the first time I've seen this kind of combination of product, right? So it kind of acts as your typical two-drive NAS machine. And then if you look at pictures of the back of it, it has an HDMI port and a SPDIF port, right? An optical output. And the idea is you just hook it up to a TV and your stereo that way, and you have kind of a basic home theater setup. There, what's the name of the? Why am I blanking on the service it uses for the HTPC? I don't know, but I mean, you're talking about $180 for the unit. Obviously, that doesn't include drives. Right. It's got an Atom SoC in there, kind of a slower one, but for the stuff that you're doing, that shouldn't be a big issue. It does have a gigabit Ethernet port. It's got USB 3 as well. Mm-hmm. HDMI, SPDIF to SATA for internal connections, and then you've got your power supply and everything there. It's a nice looking box. In terms of, you know, it's got that kind of white feel to it. And, you know, that I guess I was kind of surprised. Like, he had a little bit of an issue at first with the HDMI output not really working at all. And it turned out that he was on an old firmware that needed to be updated, and it kind of needed to be updated in a specific order. And once he got that worked out, it was fine. It updates it to the latest XBMC software version, right? And then he was able to just kind of get that up and running. And you can kind of see, if you look at the second page of the review, that it's just running an XBMC implementation to look at pictures, look at videos. It can see all the files on that NAS, obviously. And I think it can see files elsewhere on the network, right? If you have the shares set up like on your own machine or something like that too.
So essentially, right, we should point out that this is not a full-featured home theater PC. You're not running Windows. You're not running OS 10. You can make Netflix run under XBMC. We did that for an episode of Die Trying, but it is not a pleasant experience or as pleasant as most of the Netflix clients you can buy are, because Netflix went out of their way to kind of remove the hooks to allow third-party applications to attach to it. XBMC is awesome. XBMC is going to be rebranded to another name. That's a whole nother conversation. But it's a curious device to me, because, you know, it's not going to play Blu-rays. It's not going to play DVDs unless you rip them and store them on the NAS. You know, so it's essentially sort of,
true,
you know, it's an XBMC, dropped on top of a NAS. So it's kind of like not as, you know, depending on, and I'm sure I'm going to get some angry email about this or some cranky tweets, but it's like, you know, it's not as good as a, and this may not be the right thing to say, but unless you own all of your content and store all of your content on your home network, it is not going to be as easy an experience on XBMC as it would be on a Roku or an Apple TV or some of the other set-top boxes.
Yeah, you don't have access to the other apps that you would maybe be using to access other content sources, right? So
yeah,
that's true. You also kind of, it's interesting, like you have to hook a keyboard and mouse up to this NAS to take advantage of that feature, right? So you're essentially looking at, I mean, the hardware powering the NAS is essentially Bluetooth? A small computer anyway, but...
So there's no Bluetooth and no wireless remote on that?
No.
You could run plugins to do Wi-Fi control of XBMC, assuming it would run the plugins, but it's an interesting device.
Yeah, if it gets installed in plugins. Yeah, it is. I mean, he tested it out and had no playback issues with the video he had. The digital audio output was connected to pretty high-end DAC, and he said it sounded good coming out of it. It should, if it's actually digital audio, right? It's just bits coming out. So you'll probably, like, my guess is if you were playing back super high bitrate video, the Atom processor might be somewhat of a limitation, right? You're talking about the Atom, I forget which one it was, but it's a dual core part. So, you know, probably if you're doing like native rips of Blu-ray at 40 or 50 megabits per second or something like that, it may have issue with that just from a performance standpoint of decoding the video. But it was an interesting device, right? It acts as a NAS. It still has the same performance characteristics. You're talking about 110 megabytes per second reads from it, 104 megabytes per second, like writes to it or, back and forth. So you get all the performance that you normally get out of kind of a, I don't want to say low end, but like a budget or a mainstream NAS device. And if you happen to place it near a TV, you can maybe utilize it for that purpose. I think probably most people are more interested in having a NAS somewhere else, and then they build that kind of home theater PC specifically, you know, for placing next to your TV or in your home theater. And then it just streams from that NAS device, you know, and you could still do that with this. It might be paying a little bit for features you don't need on this particular model, the N2560, if we didn't mention it earlier. But it's a neat idea, kind of a convergence of these things, right? And I've definitely seen a couple of other NAS devices with HDMI and kind of third-party application plugin support built into it. So he seemed to like it. And again, the price was kind of in the right range there, about $180, just under $180 when he wrote it. So
cheap is good.
Neat device. Yeah.
We like cheap. Asus Strix GTX 780 6GB review, nearly silent gaming. You know, I'm excited because, you know, we've hit that stage with a lot of the cards where they're starting to do much more interesting things, especially on the AMD side of the fence, where they started out with the singularly awful, I think, factory designs for coolers, which opened up an opportunity for their partners to create singularly awesome cooling devices. They got all the performance out of the chips. And now we're at the point where it's, you know, GTX 780 and it's getting quiet, which is kind of a big deal because GPUs have been kind of loud.
Yeah.
Or am I overstating the joy of a silent PC?
Well, it's silent to a certain degree, right? So I have the card sitting here, and it's a pretty big video card in terms of designs, right? So if you look at the face of it here, like where your metal bracket is that you would use for installation, notice that there is a significant amount past it,
yeah,
that is height wise, right? So if you have like a really narrow or kind of a small home theater PC, you know, going down that road again, you may have trouble with the Z height on that, right? And right, it's because of the cooler, right? You can see the top heat pipe here, the biggest, I think it's a 10 mil heat pipe coming through the top. And as a result, on the back, you get these, you get the SLI bridge, like PCB just has to be kind of artificially raised for no purpose so that you can still put an SLI bridge on there if you wanted to. It's a GTX 780 GPU, so it's a pretty high performance GPU. They did, it's slightly overclocked out of the box, but not very dramatically. It does have 6 gigs of memory on it though, instead of the default 3. So you are doubling your graphics memory with that. The intent is, 4K gaming or NVIDIA Surround multi-display gaming, right? You have more access to frame buffer. 3 gigs could have possibly been a limitation at 4K, probably not, but maybe, because if you look at the AMD cards, they have 4 gigs. So this makes sure that in terms of that one specification, at least this card has more headroom in that area. But it still has fans on it, right? Like it still has these two fans and they will definitely spin most of the time. So the idea behind the Strix, you know, I don't know if we call it a design or a specification, is that at certain temperatures, at below a specific temperature, this GPU will operate with the fans not spinning at all. That temperature happens to be 65 degrees Celsius. So if the GPU on here is running and it does not get up to 65 degrees Celsius, it will operate without the fans spinning. As soon as you cross that 65C threshold, the fans will spin up and it will act like kind of your normal aftermarket graphics card. It's got a very good cooler. It's a relatively quiet cooler. The Asus DirectCU2 is kind of the design that they have. It's very similar to just like the vanilla DirectCU2 cards that they have out there. So then when they kind of talk to us about it and the marketing about it, it says certain things like if you're playing certain games, like if you're playing League of Legends or you're playing StarCraft 2, you can essentially game with a silent GPU because they're not straining the GPU very much. So in theory, the 65 degree temperature won't be reached and the fans won't spin up. Right. In my kind of quick testing, that wasn't exactly as easy as it sounded, right? So I didn't play League of Legends to be fair, but I did play Dota 2 and I played Unreal Tournament 2004, which is obviously a decade old game.
Right.
And we started playing for maybe a couple of minutes and the fans weren't spinning and we were at a totally silent, you know, as far as the graphics card was concerned, environment. But as soon as the GPU did cross 65C and then the fans came on. So to me, like the kind of default out of box experience didn't quite live up to what they had led us to expect. What kind of fixed it for me is that if you go into like PrecisionX or the AI suite software, the GPU control software, NVIDIA, mm-hmm, since the launch of the GTX 600 series cards, has had a feature called frame rate limiting. And if you enable that, I turned it on and I set it to 80 frames per second, which means the GPU would stop rendering frames quickly once it gets to 80 frames per second. And when we did that, I could play both of those games without the GPU getting up to 65C, right? And then it was actually kind of operating in that silent method that they were talking about. We had to do that modification. And it was kind of interesting to see once I limited the frame rate to 80, I kind of monitored the clock speeds and the temperatures. That's all through the same piece of software. Playing Unreal Tournament 2004 at 2560 by 1440 on this card with the frame rate limiter on, the GPU clock speed never goes above 324 megahertz or something like that, like which is the lowest speed possible. That's like the speed the GPU goes in when it's in 2D mode at Windows, right? So there's clearly the GPU headroom is there for those types of games. It's a matter of throttling back the frame rate. Like Unreal Tournament was probably, if I hadn't throttled, would maybe run at 300 frames per second or something like that. And maybe that's what's happening in Dota 2 as well. Like it just scales up infinitely, and you know, it's like, well, whatever, we've got GPU horsepower here, let's use it. You enable that limiter and it kind of keeps things held back. So I don't know if maybe Asus could have implemented something like that or made it more obvious that that's what you maybe needed to do to take advantage of it. Because I mean, when you're playing games like StarCraft 2 or Dota or League of Legends, you don't need the power of a GTX 780. You really don't. but if you also play other titles like Crysis or Metro or whatever, and you want access to the full power of the 780, that's, you would buy the 780. So it's still a really good card. It just, I don't know, that feature, the kind of the one defining feature of it and how it changed and differed from other products, even in Asus's own family, it didn't quite, wasn't as easy to use as I expected it should be.
It's kind of a bummer.
Super, super powerful card. And I still complain about this all the time. Almost all vendors don't overclock their GPUs quickly or to a high enough level out of the box. This card has, you know, 50, I think it has 30 or 40% more phases in its power delivery system to the GPU. It has a more over-engineered PCB. We were able to overclock this to like 175 megahertz over what it came out of the box at. And that's a significant performance difference, but unless you are willing to go in there and make that change in the software, which it's super easy to do, but unless you're cognizant to do it and you're willing to do it, you're just not going to get a very different experience from a much lower cost GTX 780 card on the market. So that's something, you know, Asus is not the only company that does that. MSI does that. Gigabyte does that. They kind of over-engineer these coolers and these board designs, and then they want to make sure that they leave it to the consumer to push it further than they would, right?
You is look that at, because they don't want to deal with warranty issues or because they have a sort of you broke it, you bought it mentality? Because it's not like you're going to, I don't think you're actually going to break any of these without really working at it.
No, you'd have to try really hard to break a modern GPU or a modern CPU for that matter. Honestly, I don't really know what it is, right? Because there are other companies, Zotac, for example. Zotac is relatively... They're a small brand in the U.S. They're not a big market share leader in the U.S. And so when they release some parts, they tend to push that much further, right? And they tend to have the highest clocks out of the box when they get their kind of custom-built models out there. And I think they're doing it because it's like, well, we need to stand out and gain market share, and here's how we can do this. When you look at the reviews, when it's just side-by-side, the Zotac one is going to win. Even if you could push the Asus card just as high as Zotac did theirs or further. I don't think it's a warranty issue either, because you know, Asus makes the software that allows you to overclock your graphics card. And I've never heard of an instance where somebody had just used the software as it was intended to be used and then was not able to RMA a card or something afterwards. So it's just, I don't know, something about the mentality of some of these companies that
they want you to feel the thrill of overclocking.
I guess you can look at it in a positive light. Yeah. If you look at it in a positive light, yes, that's how it's done. But you know, it's still a good card. It's pretty expensive, to be honest, though. Like I think $599 had it, which puts it at a $70 to $80 premium over some other GTX 780 cards.
We also, I mean, you point out in the sort of the tail end of your write up. Right, Amazon had it listed for $744. Newegg had it listed for $599. You know, is it? Let's go back for a second. You know, are you really getting anything out of the extra 3 gigabytes of RAM? I mean, that just seems at this point, you know, either like 4K proofing, haha, or just, you know, looking for a checkbox feature to make it stand out. Because, yeah, you know, you're looking at a, you know, street price, you're looking at a sort of $130 premium. Yeah. $100 to $200 premium over some of the competitive graphics.
Yeah, if you look at the lowest cost GTX 780s that have half the memory, you're talking about $120 right. price difference. What you get out of the memory is going to vary based on the consumer, right? I think you really do need to either have a 4K monitor or have a multi-display gaming setup, or you need to plan to get one of those soon to really need the memory that that this card offers over a standard 3 gig model. Sure. And keep in mind, like, if you ever go to a multi GPU setup, you need to make sure you have another card that has 6 gigs of memory on it. Because if you have a card that has, if you know, 3 months later, you buy a card that has 3 gigs of frame buffer, then you're only going to effectively have 3 gigs in total. Right. So you need to make sure that, I don't think you need the 6 gigs for anything right. in particular. If you have one of those Asus 4K monitors, like, they are $650, and you can buy the Samsung display for like $530 or $540 now. They're out there and people are buying them, and it could be an advantage there. But not a whole lot would be my guess. But that's traditionally been the case. Like, you see companies that will just kind of add on memory to graphics cards as a feature point, as a spec point, to try to get that feature box check better than their competition. The cooler is very similar to a cooler you could get from Asus on cheaper cards. And I would imagine that the overclocking would be pretty much identical between the lower cost Asus DirectCU2 card and the Strix card that we have here. So, had this been a little bit less expensive, you know, a little bit closer down to where the other GTX 780 cards are, or even some of the other like custom built GTX 780s, then I think it would be a really, really good option. But as it is now, it's kind of it's a good product. Like, the cooler is good, and the idea of the silent fan is good. It just needed a little bit more tweak in terms of how it was implemented in software. Either recommending when you install it to enable frame rate limiting, because you can enable frame rate limiting on a per game basis, right? You can do all these things to fix this if you want to do it manually, but you kind of have to do it manually, and there's no kind of lead in from the manufacturer. Like, this is kind of what you need to do to get this to work. Because every other game you play, if you're going to break 65 degrees Celsius pretty quickly, right? Even if you play games at 1080p and you're playing on medium quality settings, you're still going to break 65C. 65C is not a very high level for a modern GPU, right? Remember, the 290 and 290X were going up to 90 and 95C default, like, on purpose. So
a lukewarm silver reward.
I appreciate the added memory for those people that want it, because there's not a whole lot of cards out there that offer it on the NVIDIA side of things that aren't, like, if you get a Titan Black, it's going to have 6 gigs of memory, but it's $1,000 to $1,200, right? So added memory at a somewhat reasonable, much more reasonable price. A really, really good cooler, and really, really good board design. Just, you know, I wish the kind of silent aspect to it had been more well thought out or well implemented, I guess, maybe.
Well constructed, good performance, a metric ton of memory, ladies and gentlemen. I'm just saying, like, oh, you know, I mean, like, you're excited about it, but, you know, it just,
65
degrees. Flash Memory Summit, Alan Malventano, who has helped me discover that iMessage was still sucking down my SMS and text messages, which hopefully after afternoon with tech support, I have resolved. So the Flash Memory Summit 2014, Samsung announces 3D TLC V-NAND Storage Intelligence Initiative. And this is pretty breathy stuff for Alan, who writes, just minutes ago at the Flash Memory Summit, Samsung announced the production of 32-layer TLC V-NAND. This is the key to production of the soon-to-be-released 850 EVO, which should bring the excellent performance of the 850 Pro with the reduced cost benefit we saw with the previous generation 840 EVO. Here's what the progression to 3D V-NAND looks like. Now, I like using the announcer voice on that because Alan's very kind of chill guy. He's not emotionless, but he's very chill, you know. He's very excited about this. And it's really cool when you start thinking about it. So, you know, the floating gate, the insulator, and then essentially they are folding a bunch of things that are currently stacked into a layer. I can hear if goodness help me, if Alan's listening right now, he's probably laughing hysterically and typing in the chat room and, you know, making fun of me. But it's like, you know, given that Samsung's V-NAND tech has more volume to store electrons when comparing to competing 2D planar flash technology, it's a safe bet that this new TLC will come with a higher endurance ratings than those other technologies. And there's more information on page one of the 850 Pro review. It's pretty exciting, you know, and the idea that they're really working to, you know, the storage intelligence charts, the idea that if the host controller or the host software has more control, well, I'll just read Alan's words. That would be safer for everyone involved. Quote, more control over where and when the data is stored on the SSD. The end result is much more optimized write pattern, which ultimately boosts overall throughput and IOPS. We are still in the experimentation stage on storage intelligence because there are no standards or no industry standards, and it's pretty sick, advanced, cool stuff. I'm kind of excited about that. The idea that you're going to be able to sort of, you know, write multiple things or multi-stream, as I guess Samsung put it in the presentation, to a drive simultaneously. So the idea that you'll be able to hurl a bunch more stuff onto your drive that much faster, therefore increasing write speeds on SSDs. Not that SSDs aren't pretty kick-ass right now, but as processors and applications catch up and SSDs get bigger, the ability to move things onto them faster will be super awesome, to use a highly technical term. You know, I don't know. It's exciting stuff. I just realized I opened up the second article a second time. other article that Alan dropped today from Flash Media Summit 2014, HTST claims 3 million IOPS and 1.5 microsecond access time SSD. Updated with PICs. So HTST is a Western Digital company. And according to a press release, the company will bring an SSD based on phase change memory to the 2014 Flash Memory Summit in Santa Clara, California, and claim it will be at their booth on their show floor. And then if you scroll down, keep scrolling down, it does work. So have you talked to Alan at all about the phase change memory?
Not really. Not this week. He's been gone, and I was gone too in Portland for most of the week. What was interesting to me about this kind of announcement and then the demo that he saw out in Santa Clara was that they didn't really match up, right? So the title says, you know, HTST claims 3 million IOPS performance, but if you look at the metrics, if you look at the screenshots, the pictures that Alan took of the demo they were doing, they were well under that in terms of IOPS, and they're the kind of the rate of transfer was in the 450 meg range, right? So you're talking about somewhere in the 115K IOPS and 450 megs per second performance, which isn't that impressive, right? Especially even for a SATA SSD, let alone a PCI Express SSD that's supposed to be using a new phase change memory technology that's supposed to wow us and everything.
This is something, right? Like, you know, IBM has demonstrated phase change memory. Micron is talking about phase change. Everybody's like, you know, life after NAND, phase change memory. You know, that's kind of a big movement forward in the future.
I guess the issue I had was the announcement made it seem like, hey, we've got this 3 million IOPS demo. We've got like a product that looks ready. But if you look at this card, it's not a retail-ready product, right? There's all kinds of weird connectors on there you would never see on a PCB for something that's shipping to a customer, whether it be an enterprise or a consumer. And also, you know, I asked Alan to go back into the story and kind of add to it in terms of what we see there. Because, like, if you look at those, the flash chips, like, you're only looking at, by our math, like 2.5 to 3 gigabytes of storage. So a fairly small amount of SSD storage, actually.
Perhaps yields are low. I mean,
perhaps they are, yeah.
To put this into perspective, right? So, you know, you're looking at NAND is like 70 microseconds. PCM is like 1 microsecond. You know, resistant random access memory and magnetic RAM are both competing with those as low latency technologies. You know, it's funny, right? It's just a different way to store information. It's like chalcogenide. Chalcogenide. There it is. Sorry. You know, it's funny. It's this weird alloy that's storing a charge, and it goes from a gas to a crystalline format as it charge gets a charge to record like a bit. I don't know. It's fascinating. I agree with you. That's it's early. this is something, you know what I mean? Like when you're in a contest with, like, you know, Micron, IBM, and like 30 other
all
companies.
The big guys.
Yeah, I mean, I can completely, and not that Western Digital is small, but I can completely see them, like, we have a functioning product. It's how fast? Shout it from the rooftops. Because at this point, you know, it seems like, you know, whoever can get it running first and running well is going to kind of own this, or the market's going to fragment in some huge, ridiculous ways, which is a strong possibility.
So, right. Agree. Yep.
Dude, what did you think of that, X99S, English is a difficult language for me. Because MSI, it's basically the first time they revealed it anywhere was on a tweet.
So apparently they had posted it to Facebook accidentally due to an error with the Facebook page, which is obviously bullcrap. And then I didn't see it there. They posted on Twitter, right? They posted on Twitter, clearly not an accident at that point. I was like, okay, well, let's see what this is. And so they just posted this picture and they're kind of looking for feedback. But what you get out of it is a couple bits of information. You know that there is an X99 chipset. It is probably actually called the X99S chipset, based on how modeling and all that stuff goes. That there is at least one MSI motherboard that will be based on it. If you look at the second picture, I kind of like photoshopped it and brightened it all up so you could see some more of the features, because it's a really cool black PCB, black connectors, black heat sinks, black SATA connections design, and that I think actually looks really cool. It's regular light. When you brighten it up, you can kind of see some of the features. You got the 8 DIMM slots up top. You got the enormous socket there for your processor. I don't know what the name of the processor socket is going to be yet, but it'll have many, many pins to support quad channel DDR4 on there. You got 4 full length PCI Express by 16 slots. And you can tell, even just by looking at them, you can tell that the top 2 have full pin count and the bottom 2 have half pin count. So that the fastest they could run would be by 8 bandwidth. You've got 10 SATA ports on the right hand side. You've got 1 SATA Express port at the very bottom. That looks like 2 SATA ports with a little add on thing there. Other than that, not really much you can tell from it. But there's a lot of, you're going to find these motherboards to look very crowded, right? If you look up at the processor socket area, the socket plus the DIMM slots take up a ton of space. So to fit everything into a regular ATX form factor, like if you look up in the right-hand corner there above the power, connector, you're going to see it's got a lot of crowded kind of components there. You know, the fan headers are very, very, very much at the top. I think it's going to be interesting to see how these motherboard companies kind of add on features. How many layers are these boards going to have to be? And I mean, you look at that bottom right hand corner with the heatsink on the chipset with the SATA connectors and everything. It's very, very crowded, very dense down there. So I expect we'll see a lot of kind of the not the EATX, but whatever the, it was like a step between EATX and ATX where motherboard vendors just kind of extended the PCB a little bit. And it doesn't usually cause a problem with any cases, and it allows them a little bit more flexibility there. So I assume we'll see a lot of that with the Haswell E launch, which, again, now based on the fact that we're seeing motherboards motherboard pictures released kind of officially by these companies. MSI showed a different one, like a Gaming 9 with integrated 802.11ac, that it's going to be fairly soon, right? And we'll finally get the answer of how many cores are on these processors and what else you can do with them. I mean, you got 8 DIMM slots. That's 64 gigs of memory for support. If we ever get emails about, I need a lot of memory, here's your newest, fastest platform for that.
I want 64 gigabytes to run Premiere. I just want somebody else to pay for it. Well, you know what I mean? It's one of those moments where you're looking at something, you're thinking like, that's going to be awesome, and it's going to be expensive.
Yeah, and it's going to be DDR4, right? So it's going to be a brand new memory type. So it's going to be even more expensive than 64 gigs of memory would be otherwise, right? And I'm very curious to see what performance, what speeds of DDR4 memory we get. I have a pretty good idea now, based on some of the memory vendors that have been talking with me about sampling parts out. But it should be good. I'm looking forward to it. It's been a long time since we've had a platform that I really feel is a super high end part.
Right. Well, that's what I was squeezing my eyeballs into my head because you mentioned like new memory platform. And you know what I mean? New memory platform, either everything's great or you're just sitting there like watching things not boot. It's been a while since we've had a memory debut like that, but we've had them in the past.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, what are we looking at it for in terms of DDR4 performance? What are we looking at? I mean, what kind of real world impact is it going to have?
I think that you will see DDR4 memory speeds kind of start in the 1866 range and go up from there. I think I've seen some memory vendors quoting like 3,000 and 3,200 megahertz memory. I think you'll probably, if you look at DDR3 1866, it will probably match the performance you'll see at like DDR4 2133. So a couple of bend steps forward, right? That's kind of usually the case, right? Because DDR4 slows down some areas but allows higher frequencies, right? And so that's how it gets its performance advantage. And so I think you'll see like DDR4 2133 kind of be the point at which it overtakes. And that'll kind of be like the default spot, I think, for enthusiasts to buy memory at. We'll have to see, you know, what the processors kind of officially support from Intel versus what the motherboard vendors will support, you know, natively. Asus has traditionally done a very, very good job of kind of qualifying a bunch of memory kits that when you plug them in, they just work out of the box, right? So if you get like a Corsair DDR4 3000 kit, you plug it into an Asus X99 board, I would expect that to just work and be incredibly fast at the same time. What's it going to add to performance? It's not going to be a huge amount, right? Because memory bandwidth is still not a lot of applications are taking advantage of higher speed memory bandwidth. More memory, yes, but we'll have to see kind of a benchmark to benchmark comparison there, which ones are actually utilizing the bandwidth improvement, right? So lots of applications running at the same time. Yes, more memory and higher memory bandwidth will help. Single application, you know, benchmark performance metrics, probably a little bit harder to tell. But I don't have, you know, and on pricing, I have no idea where it's going to sit at launch.
I feel hopefully like this is going to be an expensive platform.
Oh, it will. I mean, there's going to be a $1,000 processor and there's going to be $400 or $500 motherboards. And memory, you know, if you get the 32 gig and 64 gig kits, you're probably talking another $300 or $400 for those. Is just kind of my guess, right? And then and go from there in terms of like video cards and stuff you want to get. But there will be a $1,000 processor and there will be a $500 processor probably. And kind of, you know, Intel's not real creative when it comes to these things. They're going to kind of rinse and repeat what they have done with Sandy Bridge and Ivy Bridge.
It's working. They're making money hand over fist. Why would they fix this? Why would they get it crazy?
They're making these parts. Don't think that Intel is making these parts exclusively for like enthusiasts. The reason these parts exist is because server and workstation markets are there, right? And they're paying $3,000 and $4,000 per processor for super high core counts. And so Intel kind of goes, well, why not just scale it back just a little bit, sell it for less money, sell it to this high-end enthusiast brand that is super eager and super hungry for a new product and new performance levels. We'll make a little bit of money off of it. It's not going to be a super high volume part like Haswell is, like the consumer level Haswell, but it will do, it will make some money and it will be great press and media, and it will do nothing but, you know, kind of offer goodwill to those consumers that, you know, and media like us who just say, Intel is stalling in the market because they have no competition, right? So they're trying to prevent that mindset from taking place, taking hold.
Taking hold, taking place, taking time. In any case, you're going to need to save your pennies if you want to buy one of these new processors, unless you're incredibly wealthy, in which case you probably don't think about fixing your own stuff, and you should. You should check out our sponsor, ifixit.com/twit. If you enter in the code TWIT, you get $10 off a $50 purchase. I mentioned earlier the eye opener. I have a big old stack of. I paid for this out of my own pocket. It's for loosening glued-on screens, like on the iPad too. I mentioned earlier, which I think I've beaten that subject to the death, so I won't go any more on it. But you know, iFixit's really amazing, right? It's a free online repair manual for everything. They started out with like Macs and then iPhones and iPads, and then they moved on to other electronic devices. Their teardowns are amazing if you haven't seen them. I'm always incredibly amazed that they take these products apart for the first time and everything comes apart without being broken into small pieces. But they've kind of opened it up to the idea that they're going to be your free online repair manual for anything. The people at iFixit are committed worldwide to trying to help people figure out how to fix things and make them last longer. It's pretty awesome. They have more than 10,000 repair guides for everything from electronics like your smartphone, tablets, game consoles, home appliances, clothing, even your bike. And, you know, especially for the stuff that where they sell parts, they've got really foolproof instructions to help you fix your stuff. A lot of them are professionally done by the iFixit crew. Some of them are submitted by people in the iFixit community. But it's really cool. Like, if you want to repair the Red Ring of Death on an Xbox or swap the battery in your Galaxy S3, iFixit is going to help you by helping you get the tools, the parts, and more importantly, really most importantly, the knowledge you need. Because, you know, opening up something like this isn't that bad. But you don't want to have to figure it out yourself.
New.
So let's take a moment to take a quick look at a couple of their products. The ProTech Toolkit. We've got one of these we use constantly on Diatryon. 70 tools to assist you with any mod, malfunction, or misfortune that comes your way. The toolkit is the gold standard for electronics work, from garage hackers to, quote, the CIA and FBI, unquote. Seriously, these tools are used by repair technicians everywhere. There's the 54-bit driver kit, which iFixit has been selling for a while, Phillips bits, Pentalobe bits, or as I like to call them, delete expletive Pentalobe bits from Apple. They use them on their iPhones and their Mac laptops. There are three different sizes of Pentalobe bits right now. Torx, Torx security bits, Tri-Wing bits, Triangle bits. Triangle bits are basically used on McDonald's toys, which I think is a sign that iFixit has a little bit of a sense of humor. Really nice swivel top precision driver, a flex extension if you have to get to a screw that's in a weird place inside of a case. They're really, really well made. There's a, you know, set of ESD safe tweezers. If you are the belt and suspenders kind of person, they've got an anti-static wrist strap, which is really, really nice for electronics repairs, and Arduino if you actually put it on. Spudgers, nylon spudgers, metal spudgers, plastic opening tools, which look like tar picks, but are much more sophisticated, I swear. It all comes in a lightweight, compact, portable tool roll that'll go into your big toolbox or in your drawer. It's really, really nice. You know, and iFixit wants you to know that, you know, you could use it for eyeglasses, cabinet doors, sink fixtures, little tiny bits on your car. It's just a nice all-around collection of drivers and tools to help you get things done. And there are thousands of free iFixit guides to give you the knowledge you need to get those things done. So I'm a big fan of iFixit. I've known Kyle and the crew over there for years. I've been buying their products for years. I've been helping, using them to help. They've been helping me fix an endless cavalcade of broken screens in my life for a long time. The toolkit we're talking about here, the ProTech toolkit, is my goodness, if I could read that number there, $64.95, backed by a lifetime warranty. And they're really nice tools. And, you know, one DIY screen repair could pay for the whole thing a couple, three times over if you've got an expensive smartphone. Seriously, with iFixit, you can fix it yourself. Visit iFixit.com/twit for the free step-by-step guides. iFixit also sells every part and tool you'll need. Plus, if you enter the code TWICH, T-W-I-C-H, at checkout, you'll save $10 off any $50 purchase. Or $50 purchase or more. iFixit.com/twit. Use the code TWITCH and get a big old fat discount. We want to thank iFixit for the support of This Week in Computer Hardware and for making really good stuff that works. I like it when it does what it says on the box. Makes me really, really happy. So Twitch at twit.tv is the email address. He's at Ryan Trout. I'm at Patrick Norton if you are on the at Twitter. And Clarence has a question about upgrading a non-gaming rig. Never upgrade a non-gaming rig. That's our advice. I was like, no. I was like, is that Skype lag or is he really just upset at that response? Clarence writes in, Twitch viewer since the cottage days, first time emailer. Thanks, Clarence. Thanks to a stray bolt of lightning 18 months ago, I now own an HP Pavilion from Wally World, AMD A6 3650, a 2.6 gigahertz, 8 gigs of RAM. After transplanting an HD 6530 card and my Blu-ray burner into it, the box does its job, playing Blu-rays, occasional video and audio transcoding very well. I'm looking to upgrade my monitor from a 23-inch 1080p to a 27 to 30-inch 1440 or 1600, maybe even one of those Seiki 39-inch 4K jobbies. Wish, wish, wish. Don't do that. I'll tell you about that another time. I know it needs more video power to do any of these. So first things first, I got to get another graphics card. My budget tells me to look at an NVIDIA GT 730 with 2 gigs of DDR5 or a Radeon R7240 with 2 gigabytes of DDR3. There will be no games played on this system because I am lacking in hand-eye coordination. Would either of these cards get the pixel pitching job done or should I go with another cheap card? Yeah, you know... Is there anything in 2D or basic desktop operation that's going to require much of a card? I mean, you know, an NVIDIA 630 should actually do it, right?
Yeah, so...
You know, Intel 4400 graphics should do it,
so the
right?
the only thing, yeah, it should...
Or I should say the AMD
graphics. You want to be able to support... So, you know... Anything that supports dual link DVI will be able to run a 2560 by 1440 monitor. If you want to do 4K, I think Patrick was alluding to, you probably don't want to buy that Seiki TV, right? Even though it's really cheap because it's a 30 hertz monitor. You want a 60 hertz monitor, especially, I think, not just for gaming, but for actually using your PC as a PC. You want a 60 hertz display. They have an expensive 60 hertz 4K displays now. You can get them in the 550 range for that Samsung. I can't remember the model number, but there's a Samsung 4K panel that's like in the 550 to 600 range. The Asus is maybe $50 more. Those will require DisplayPort. So I don't think your HD 6530 will probably not have DisplayPort. It may. I think it's probably a good idea to upgrade to something like a GT 730 or an R7240 just because it will have better kind of display throughput. I don't know. That's not the right terminology I'm looking for here. But something that's going to have more complete support for the display technologies that are out now. Right? Because the HD 6530 is, let's see, you had the 7000 series, and now you're up into, you know, you've got at least one full generation, a long generation, but one full generation going across that, right? And if you start to look at GT 730s, the issue you may have is finding them that have DisplayPort on them. Usually when you look at the kind of like the lower end parts, they tend to have DVI, VGA, and HDMI. Yeah, there's one right there, right? So that's DVI, VGA, and HDMI, exactly as I was talking about. But you want to make sure you have a DisplayPort connection. If you are worried about kind of your DisplayPort connectivity moving forward, I'm sure they have them, and I would imagine we'd be able to find that looking through like Newegg. Let's see, what do we have here? HDMI, DVI, cool. Yeah. So you can find some of these, and you may have to step up to like maybe a 740 or a 750, or maybe go up to an R7 R9280, or what do they have above that? R7 260, 260X. Those are the newest GPUs from AMD. They'll assuredly have a DisplayPort connection on them. You might pay, you know, you can probably get a GTX 750, a non-TI card for, let me look here what we got. You've got like $120 or something like that. Fairly, I think, yeah, actually less than that, $109, $99 for a GTX 750. You get better display support out of it. You're going to get kind of a newer GPU, newer display pipeline. If you get the R7 260, you're talking about the same investment. I think if you're going to get a nice display, make sure you have the GPU behind it. Even if you're not gaming, keep in mind that Windows and everything still uses GPU acceleration for just about everything that it does. You could use an integrated, like you mentioned, the HD 4400 or 4600 from Intel, right? You could use that. I have had a couple of issues where certain SKUs don't support anything above 25 by 16. So if you decided to go to the 4K route, you might have an issue there, and you might have an issue with 4K at 60 on those parts. So that would be something to keep in mind. But if you get, you know, you can spend $100 or less on an R7 260 or GTX 750 and get a card that you know is going to support all the resolutions at all the refresh rates that you are potentially looking to invest in. Mm-hmm. So GT730 and R7240 will work if you find them with DisplayPort connections. I just want you to have a DisplayPort connection, because I don't want you to buy a monitor in 5 months or 6 months that you do not have the connectivity for, and you have to start using these adapters that are going to start jacking with your refresh rates and everything. Yeah, so that connection on the far left there is a full-size DisplayPort connection. You can have a mini DisplayPort. That's fine too. But you want to make sure you have at least a DisplayPort connection on there. You don't have to have it for like a 25 by 14 monitor or 25 by 16 monitor. But if you're going to investigate 4K, you're going to want a DisplayPort connection for sure.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. We got an email from Bruce regarding SSDs. He uses a lot of power. He sent us a link to a ZDNet article by Robin Harris for Storage Bits up at ZDNet.com. Power-hungry SSDs hotter than disks. So there was a Usenix Hot Storage 2014 paper, Power, Energy, and Thermal Considerations in SSD-Based I/O Acceleration. A group of researchers from the University of Texas in Dallas examined high-end SSDs, quote, those with multiple channels, cores, and flash chips. Fast, robust SSDs all need all the help they can get. And so what they found, high-performance SSDs often consume 2 to 7 times the power, like 282% power higher for reads, up to 18 watts total, 150 to 210% higher than conventional SSDs, temperatures up to 182 degrees Fahrenheit, which is kind of hot. Performance throttling, basically, like once the SSDs hit 180 degrees, performance can be throttled by like 16%, they found. And then the largest... the largest writes created the highest temperatures, quote, likely due to the extra garbage collection and wear leveling overhead. A mid-range drive slowed down at 170 degrees, probably it due to thermally induced malfunction as the drive had no autonomic power adjustments. So Mr. Harris from the Storage Bits, quote, found these results a little hard to believe. So he looked at some high-end enterprise SSD specs and found an Intel SSD spec to 25 watts, which is twice the power that would be consumed by a 15,000 RPM enterprise drive. And actually, apparently, is higher than the power consumption of any of the drives tested by the researchers, who were shocked and amazed. You know, one, this isn't a particularly huge issue if you have good case airflow, you know, for gamers or for people who aren't moving bits on and off the drive constantly. I think it's a much bigger deal in an enterprise situation with servers, which are constantly moving data on and off the disk. But, you know, it's an interesting thought. Quote, for enterprise users, writes Mr. Harris, this is a reminder to check specs and understand power and cooling requirements for high-density SSD installations, i.e. racks and racks and racks of these drives. If you're replacing a bunch of 50,000 RPM drives with a bunch of SSDs, your cooling requirement for that rack may have just doubled or more than doubled. Quote, free-cooled data centers may also be at risk for SSD-induced slowdowns. So the idea that your data center may not be, your data center may not be ready to deal with all of the heat coming off these drives. I think this is also a reminder that you always want to make sure you have good airflow inside of the case, that you position devices inside your case so there's air moving over them, that they're not basically pulling hot air onto more critical devices inside of your case. I don't think it's going to be nearly as dramatic for most home users. And again, airflow is important inside your case.
I think I was surprised, even though having thought back to it, I remember Alan and us talking about it when the SSD 730 series from Intel launched, that 25 watt spec was on a controller they essentially were overclocking, right? Like it was a controller that they built for the enterprise that they overclocked to bring to consumer levels. And it does seem a little odd that it's that high, but I agree with you. I don't think it's really going to affect much in terms of consumer effects.
Because at one point we were bumping up against like 200 watts on CPUs. GPUs are consuming enormous amounts of electricity. Yeah. I think it's much more critical. I remember the first time I saw Xi, I think, made the really huge NASs that we use, because we generate like terabytes of video every week. And it's essentially, like a 4 foot long drawer packed with drives. And a 4 foot long drawer packed with drives has one, it's designed to pull enough air through it to cool the drives for the spec, which, right, are, our server grade drives, the longer drives. You suddenly double the thermals on that device. I think all hell's going to break loose, and not in a fun kind of like Friday night, let's go get partying kind of way. It's interesting to think about. I think it's, as the writer pointed out, much more critical in the enterprise environment than it is in the consumer environment. Oh, yeah. There's a big old stack of drives right there. Don't you be breaking the internet in your office or the office backup system. Yeah. If you did see that picture at home, think about it. Imagine like 8 foot high racks just stuffed like that. And that's when you walk inside of a lot of data centers, it's like walking into a hurricane because they're moving around air really hard, really fast, and trying to keep the thermals controlled for a whole lot of electronics generating a whole lot of heat. So good write-up. Yeah. We got an interesting question from Dave about water cooling GPUs, but I think we should hold that till next week. And if you got any water cooling questions, fire them out to Twitch at twit.tv or at Ryan Schroud or at Patrick Norton. So Alan's been out here at the Flash Storage Summit. You're actually mm-hmm. been home for a few days. Intel Developers Forum is no.
No.
You're not going to be home for a few days?
No, I was gone all this week as well. I was in Portland meeting with other people, so which will all be revealed on Monday. So you won't have to wait long to figure out where I was at and what I was doing and why I was in Portland.
Notice the Intel. Why else would you be in Portland?
Okay, yeah, that's fine. But Monday is turning out to be an incredibly busy day. Like, if you come to the website on Monday morning, you will find a story at 8, a story at 9, and a story at noon. Like, all pretty big announcements that I think are pretty interesting that we'll talk about on next week's show, for sure.
I will be sure to look at those before I start writing up Techzilla on Monday. And if you have questions about Chromebooks, we did our Chromebook challenge last week. Shannon and I both spent a week doing as much of our life as possible on Chrome OS Chromebooks. It was interesting. They worked really, really well. They're like $350. If there's no Chrome app for what you want to do, you're dead in the water. But other than that, it's funny, right? Because, we've had so many horrible sort of, devices come out. Netbooks, this is great. It's so cheap. It's so light. It's so useless when you get three things running simultaneously. The Chromebook was not like that. It was also interesting because the one that Shannon tested was a Samsung with a 13-inch screen with a Samsung proprietary processor inside of it. And I was running with a Core i3. So it was kind of funny to to be like, wow, it's a great big fat notebook and there's something inside of it. And it didn't come from Intel and it didn't come from AMD. So, you know, go Samsung. It was interesting stuff. At PCPer.com is where you can find Mr. Ryan Stroud. I'm usually found at Techzilla or DIYTRYIN. We actually had a lot of fun with the Raspberry Pi this week. We built a bathroomstatus.com monitor. We are the heroes of our office. Mostly Michael's the hero of our office. You laugh, man. You've never been in an office with 54 people and two bathrooms.
That's true. We have very true.
We have made mad increases to office productivity because there's no more walking to the bathroom and finding out that you
can. That's pretty cool.
On that bright and cheerful note, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to take advantage of being able to look out the window or on the internet to find out if the potty is open. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shroud.
We'll see you next week on Twitch. Raspberry Pi, people.